Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Boy George.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Where to start with today's guest? He is genuinely an icon, a pop star in the truest classic meaning of the words. He's a man who found huge international fame as the singer of the band Culture Club, breaking the US market and becoming a household name. But he's also someone who brought the counterculture into the mainstream. George O'Dowd channeled Bowie, Lee Bowery, Lou Reed, Warhol, punk, and the London club scene, and the flamboyant, witty, golden-voiced character he created became one of the biggest stars of the 80s. These days, maybe the line between George and the character is almost invisible, if it exists at all. So it brings me a huge amount of pleasure to welcome to The First Time, Boy George. Here we talk about George's childhood obsessions with Mark Bolan and David Bowie, the new romantic scene he helped shape, and Culture Club's first single and famous hits. We also discuss his difficult relationship with fame and the tabloids, and his own battles with substance abuse and the end of the band. But we also talk about his glorious return as the man behind the hit stage show Taboo, and the hugely loved and respected artist that he is today. But I started by asking George, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music as a child?
Must have been from like 6 or 7 years old, really. I remember sort of Irish rebel songs were a big thing. You know, I remember growing up listening to a lot of these songs that were kind of banned in the UK at the time. Apparently that was what we were told. You mustn't play these too loud because we'll be arrested.
Wow.
And sort of, you know, Dean Martin, Sinatra, Johnny Ray, all of that stuff that my mum played.
Okay.
And also stuff on the radio, but also my dad was a builder. So my dad was always clearing out houses. So we'd often come home with piles of records. And I was really the only one that went through them and sort of explored them. And then, of course, my older brother, Richard, you know, it was a big influence on me as a kid. You know, my older brother was always playing exotic things and I'd be like, oh, what's this, you know?
Yeah, that's often the thing, isn't it? If you've got an elder sibling, there's a bit of hero worship for their kind of music taste. What kind of thing do you remember him playing?
Well, that's where I first heard Bowie, The Man Who Sold the World. And, you know, I said this in my book, that I used to think my brother was a genius, but it was just allowed out. So it was kind of like access, really, more than genius.
We passed upon the stair. We spoke of what and when. Although I wasn't there, he said I was his friend. Which gave us some surprise. I spoke into his eyes. I thought you died alone a long, long time ago.
This is where I first heard Alice Cooper and Mott the Hoople and, you know, all sorts of things. But then I quickly sort of developed my own taste for music. Well, when I was very, very young, a very young kid, you know, I'd love to say I was into really cool music, but I was just into everything. Irish show tunes, you know, Tom Jones and Dusty Springfield, Sandy Shaw, Lulu, all those sorts of things. You know, I loved Voices.
Yeah. I never trust it if I interview anyone and they're always like, oh, the first record I bought was Kraftwerk. I'm like, no, it wasn't. It was the Wumbles. Be honest. Come on. I always prefer people to be frank about these things.
My first 45 is Melanie Alexander Beatle.
What's that?
Like this crazy song that Melanie recorded about a beetle.
What, like a beetle the insect or a beetle the...
A little beetle that she put in a box. It's a really strange song. And I listened to it recently and I just thought, what possessed me to fall in love with this song, you know?
I had a little beetle, so that beetle was his name. And I called him Alexander, and he answered just the same. And I put him in a matchbox, and I kept him all the day. But Nanny let my beetle out, Nanny let my beetle out. She went and let my beetle out, and beetle ran away.
You mentioned the radio. It's been documented a fair bit about like you seeing Mark Bolan on TV for the first time and that kind of being a huge impactful moment. Was it really as much of a life-changing thing seeing and hearing Metal Guru?
1,000%. I am still a massive Mark Bolan fan. I mean, Bowie and Mark Bolan, to me, equally important. I think that Mark was kind of the undisputed king of glam in a way. And if you go back to sort of early Tyrannosaurus Rex, it was so nutty and so genius. You know, when you're a kid listening to things like Salamander Palaganda and was born to be my unicorn. And then, you know, even later on, you know, just some of the lyrics that Mark Bolan wrote, they were just so brilliant and so surreal and just so nonsensical. It's been a massive influence on me as a writer. One of the reasons why I wrote songs like Church of the Poison Mind and Karma Chameleon was because I grew up listening to these T-Rex songs that were, you know, the first thing you saw was a song title. You know, you had to play it.
When did you first realise that you had that voice, that you could sing, that you could, like, you know, kids when they're growing up, everyone sings, singing choir, sing at school, but there's having that instrument, isn't there? When did you first realise that, do you think?
I think pretty early on, you know, like 7, 8, I was always singing, and people used to say, you've got a lovely voice. I was always, like, entertaining everyone singing, all those annoying kids. You
know? He's off again, here he goes. Okay, so we've done... first album that you owned? Because like a single's one thing, a single's just a brilliant sort of bubblegum fix of a tune, but with an album, you kind of go in deeper, you start to kind of get a relationship with the artist. What was the first album that you really fell in love with?
It would have been like Electric Warrior. That was the one, you know, that really kind of blew my mind. And still, I still think it's a great record. Because some records don't wear well.
Yeah.
There are some things you think, did I really think this was great? And then I think with T-Rex, there's always, like, I always go back and think, oh, I still love this. You know, I still love it as much as I did when I first heard it.
Yeah. Can you remember going and actually buying it? Was it one of those Woolworths purchases?
There was a record shop in Eltham High Street that was the coolest place in the planet that had listening booths.
Come on.
We were then there after school, listening to records. And the guy was very nice. He really liked me and he would turn me on to stuff. So, have you heard this? And yeah. I remember actually buying a copy of Here, There and Everywhere by Emmylou Harris and booking it on the way home. But it still played. I still got it somewhere. It cracked right through, but it still played. That was the thing about vinyl. It was quite durable, wasn't it? It was like,
yeah.
That still played, even though I broke it.
The good first. What was the first gig that you went to?
The first exciting gig was Bowie at the Lewishmodium, but I think before that, I went to see Medicine Head. Do you remember them?
Yeah. Where was that?
I think they might have been Greenwich Town Hall.
And what do you remember from the show?
I remember sort of people like putting their heads on the speakers and, you know, I didn't really know much of their music. It was just I'd heard a couple of songs. It wasn't like going to see Bowie where I knew everything.
Yeah.
Most of the bands I went to see, I knew every record they made, you know. So with the sort of Medicine Head gig, I knew one song. So it was a bit prog. I remember sort of forcing myself to have a good time.
Did you have that thing where you're standing in the audience at those shows, looking at the stage and thinking, that's what I want to do?
Yeah, always wanted to be on stage from a little kid, really, just thinking, oh, yeah, that's what I want to do. That's where I belong.
You knew that even from an early age, that's where you were destined to be.
Absolutely. From the moment I got my first pair of tap shoes.
I think I read about you going to a Who gig in like 74 or something.
Yeah, no, the Who at Cheltenham Football Ground.
Was, yeah, that was it.
The big moment. But I actually went to see Lou Reed.
That's it.
So it was Lou Reed, Maggie Bell, the Who, Humble Pie, Average White Band. I mean, it was unbelievable. I went specifically to see Lou Reed. That was around the time of Rock and Roll Animal. And I didn't have a ticket, so I managed to get through a hole in the fence. And it was raining, as it was in those days. I wasn't meant to go, and I wasn't meant to be home by about 6 o'clock. And then I remember leaving as the Who were doing Boris the Spider. And I remember thinking, I'm dead. I'm so getting killed when I get home. But I also felt so liberated, you know, in my sort of soaked flares. I had these flared jeans on that were just rancid, you know, these pair of platform shoes. And I remember just thinking, I'm prepared to be beaten for this, you know. I thought, I wasn't beaten, but I was definitely grounded for a few weeks.
What was Lou like?
Amazing. I mean, it was like, I knew the song, so I was just in love, you know, and also it was gorgeous. His hair and the leather jacket and I remember sort of watching interviews of Lou Reed around that time, and the things he said were so outrageous. You know, that great interview where they say, are you a homosexual or a transvestite? He goes, something like, maybe. Met him once at Joe's Pub in New York. So Lou Reed was in the same booth as me with Laurie Anderson, and I was sitting there just going, oh my God, Lou Reed, I've got to be cool. And at the end of the gig, Lou got up. He kind of got up, and this fan walked up and said, oh, can I take a picture? And he was fumbling with the camera, and Lou Reed said to him, anytime this week, which is the line I've used myself, actually. And then he looked, gave me a little wink and laughed and walked off. And that was brilliant, you know, because I didn't speak to him at the gig, but I was sitting there trying not to stare at him, you know, just thinking, oh my God, it's Lou Reed. Oh my God.
What Lou track should we play at this juncture then?
Probably Vicious.
First time you were on stage, like first gig that you played?
First gig was at Bow Wow Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
I was pushed on stage by Malcolm McLaren.
Really?
At the end of this massive gig at the Rainbow Theatre. So Bow Wow Wow did this huge gig at the Rainbow Theatre in Finsbury Park, and they had like a fairground. It was like huge. It was the biggest, trendiest gig ever. And Malcolm decided that in the encore, instead of them going back on, I'd go on instead of Annabella. So I was pushed on stage and I sang this song called Cast Iron Arm by Peanuts Wilson. I'm actually thinking of re-recording it. It's so hilarious. This mad rockabilly song. Don't mess with me because I got a cast iron arm. It was like the stupidest thing ever. I think Malcolm was just trying to be funny. But, you know, the booing and the shock of me just walking on stage.
The other night, me and my girl went falling. Joe's, that's where everybody goes. When we walk in.
Turn on, boy.
I said, don't mess with me, 'cause I got a cast on. Jumping with jive. Oh, well, the music was a rockin' and the joint was a jumpin' with jive. Oh, well, the same cool number made the same wrong move.
I hit him in the head.
I said, don't mess with me, 'cause I got a cast on arm.
What a first gig, though.
No, they were like, this guy, get off, you know. And then I did one other gig with them at Manchester Poly, and then I got fired.
Six. Every Friday throughout summer, we've been celebrating dance music across the decades with
Six Music, Three Forever.
And this Friday, it's your shouts going out.
Raving crew.
We're hearing from you as you shout out your raving mates and request a track that's brought you together on the dance floor.
Eat, sleep, rave, repeat.
Let's check.
It could be your crew from back in the day or someone you met in the club last week.
We're up on night to get lucky.
It's non-stop dance tracks from all genres and all decades.
Six Music, Rave Forever.
This Friday from 7 a.m. until 4 p.m. Matt Everett's The First Time with Boy George.
Six.
Music.
When I ask people about the first rehearsal they had with the band that they find success with, it's either like, you know, oh yeah, we started playing, we looked at each other in the rehearsal studio, and I thought, yep, there's something elemental here, this is great. Or everyone looks around and just goes, this is shocking, this is awful, but I guess we'll just keep doing it because it might go somewhere. Which, the first Culture Club rehearsal, maybe
I think
it was
a mixture of both, really, because I wanted to be in Susie and the Banshees. So, you know, I was a goth. So I'd gone into the rehearsals with all these songs that I'd written sort of about dying and death. And we were actually originally called In Praise of Lemmings.
Right.
You could see where my head was at that point. John Moss came along and wanted us to do like Private Number by William Kay and Judy Bell. You know, it was like, ugh, you know, because I was friendly with Kurt Brandon from Theatre of Hate, and John was like, oh, he used to call them Spear of Mid-European Angst. And like, say, he was like, oh, this music's really depressing, because he'd come from the punk scene.
Mm.
And he definitely wanted it to be brighter and chirpier. And somehow we ended up with this insane sound that was like a mixture of all the different people's ideas in the room. But I'd never really thought of myself as a soul singer. That was the funny thing. I was a big Bowie fan. I loved Susie and the Banshees and Fad Gadget and all those sorts of bands. Bauhaus. That's where I wanted to go. And how we ended up doing what we did. I think it was because I fancied John. You know, that was the sort of, oh yeah, he's really cute. All right, then let's do this.
And thus, great careers and music history was born.
I wanted a boyfriend more than I wanted a band, I think. And when John came along, he was so cute. I think what was good about John was he was very sort of determined that we should be commercial. Because we were called In Praise of Lemmings. Then we were called Sex Gang Children. And I actually gave that name to the Sex Gang Children. So Andy rang me up and said, oh, we hear you're not using the name. And I was like, yeah, I have it. So that's an interesting fact that nobody knows about.
Take me to God in a world of blankets.
It didn't happen straight away. The first single, White Boy, I mean, it didn't happen, didn't it? I mean, it didn't really...
I didn't say that, but the thing is, I went to the Camden Palace and I saw, like, dance floor dancing to it. So, to me, it did happen. Do you know what I mean?
All right.
I mean, it didn't happen in terms of being a hit in the Matrix, of course not. But to me, I've never made a record. Suddenly, I had this record and I went to the Camden Palace and I saw the DJ playing and people were dancing to it. And I was like, oh, it was so exciting. So, for us... I think we sold about 8,000 copies, which felt like huge. Do you know what I mean? When you're sort of little kid from Woolwich, we didn't know about success and charts and, you know, so obviously in hindsight, people said it was a flop. But to me personally, it was like, people have bought this record. You know, there's people that are dancing to it. So, you know, it was humble beginnings, really. And then the second single, I'm Afraid of Me, similarly, you know, I always felt like that should have been a hit. And then it was, you know, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, which was the song I didn't want to put out. I was the one that was like, no, this is too slow. This is, you can't dance to it. It's depressing. It's personal. But then the sort of reggae thing started to creep in because I loved reggae as well. The reggae thing was the deciding factor on the sound that we started to make. And then we started to explore the soul thing because I loved Gladys Knight and the Pips. I loved the Stylistics, but I also loved all my goth stuff. I mean, I'm a Gemini. I like everything. There's nothing I don't like, really. I just don't like anything rubbish.
So, I mean, how well can you remember that first Top of the Pops appearance, where the kind of the world shifted on his axis a little bit?
I remember the night before we got a phone call saying, do you want to be on Top of the Pops? And we were like, oh my God. It's like, yes. And I think I was awake all night, kind of just planning what I was going to wear, laying clothes on the floor in my little flat St. John's Wood, going, what about this? What about this? And I remember sort of sitting and doing my plaits with the ribbons. And I remember deciding to wear bare feet because I love Sandy Shaw. So I thought, I'm going to go with no shoes and socks on, because she did that on Ready, Steady, Go. It was a really, really exciting, kind of thrilling. I mean, Top of the Pops was sort of like what I watched every week religiously. I was like glued to it. And the Sunday chart, I would walk around the streets with a transistor radio to my ear, listening to the chart rundown. So being on Top of the Pops was everything. It was like, oh my God, we're basically superstars.
Well, this is it. I kind of think that, and it's obviously nice being such a Bowie fan, that like Bowie had that kind of Starman moment on Top of the Pops that really shifted things for people. And your performance kind of did a similar thing. It's kind of a nice sort of duality there between both those moments, because lots of people talk about that Do You Really Want to Hurt Me performance and how it changed things for them in a very real way, just like that Starman performance did.
Yeah, I think it was unconscious, though. It was just really me sort of naively just thinking, that's what you do on Top of the Pop. Because that's where I saw all my favourite bands, you know. And Top of the Pops was really a place where you got your information about fashion, about the bohemian world of rock and roll. So it just felt like I knew I had to do something that was like different to everyone else, you know.
Can you remember like the following morning? Because this is, if you picture it in your mind as being like, okay, we do this performance, it goes out Thursday evening. The following day, I guess the world was different.
But in those days, I used to walk around, I was always dressed like that. That wasn't just for TV. Yeah, life changed instantly. It was like, I went into a department store to get some makeup, which in those days was a guy going up to a makeup counter in a department store. It was just, you know, it was always complicated, you know. And I remember sort of being with Phil Pickett, who was our keyboard player within that band Sailor. So he'd been through the 70s fame thing. And we walked into this department store in Scotland and I got mobbed by these housewives. And they're like, can I have one telly? Oh, I love your song. And Phil said, that's it. You're done with anonymity. That's it. And I was like, okay, whatever, you know.
How do you think you cope with it?
To begin with, it was fantastic because it was an unknown world. It was like, you don't know what's going to happen, you know, and I would make sure everyone could see me all the time. But then what happens is you start to get anxious about it. I remember at that point, everybody was trying to find photographs of me without my makeup on. So a lot of my friends were like selling photos of me to the tabloids and looking disgusting and, you know, with no makeup on. And right now, at this point in my life, I can't believe I cared, because now I really don't care. You know, I mean, I love dressing up, but I also walk around like a tramp a lot of the time. And, you know, I don't mind if people come up to me. But in those days, it was like, oh, I have to look a certain way. I took it more seriously. You know, it was like a real pressure that I put on myself. It's really only in the last 10 years that I've really started to enjoy being me. Boy George isn't a sort of third party character. It is me, but people treat me differently when I'm dressed up. And I have to accept that that's just part of the process. But I have more fun with it now because I see it for what it is. I just enjoy it. I just, I'll actually say it on stage. I say it. I love being Boy George.
Contradiction, you come and go, you come and go.
you broke the US, you broke America. Now, like, you know, working class kids from the UK, from Woolwich, or, like, aren't supposed to do that. Not to the scale. That doesn't happen. It's very, very rare. It's still rare for a British act to break it. And there's famous, and there's 80s in America famous. It's a whole different scale.
Yeah. Again, I think it was because we weren't trying to conquer America. I mean, I wasn't consciously trying to conquer anywhere. And I went to New York completely naively, you know, just thinking, oh, yeah, it's going to be like England, you know. And, you know, obviously, when we turned up in New York in 82 or 83, it was like a spaceship had landed. Because the way we looked and the way everybody else looked, everybody looked like they were in Cheers. You know, with wide lapel jackets, big collared shirts. It was still quite 70s. And there we were, kind of like in all that gear, you know. And some of the questions I got asked were hilarious. But I think because I was so matter of fact about it all, you know, I was never really been pretentious. I've never sort of thought dressing up made me, I don't know, I'm just not one of those people. You know, you've met them, right? I look great and I am, you know, people sort of believe what they wear. I never really believed that. I always knew I was George from Elton. I always knew that what I wore was provocative. It was deliberate. But I also quite enjoyed being very kind of matter of fact about things. And I think that was the thing that people sort of looked at me and thought, oh my God, what's this? And then I opened my mouth and I was quite ordinary. And I think that was part of the sort of attraction. It was like, oh.
I think you're right. I think when you look at the level of tabloid attention and tabloid brutality, really, and sometimes the way that you dealt with that, it was, you know, almost that sort of quite Oscar Wildean, just quite flippant, just your wit were just, oh, it's just water off a duck's back, this stuff. And it, that's how it kind of felt. But I can't imagine it would have been like that underneath. It felt like a really good way of dealing with that amount of attention was just to be, if not flippant, then certainly like, oh, you know, I'm not going to take this too seriously.
There was a point when I started to really get affected by it, you know, because it became unbearable, particularly when I was going through my drug addictions and all of that. And they were printing like headlines, like find him. Like I was a sort of, I was being hunted and that was quite intimidating. And there was like paparazzis that were following me in cars and I was having to jump over walls and climb across rooftops. It got very stressful at one point. And some of it did feel very personal. Some of it did feel like personal attacks. You know, I mean, I think in general, the press, it generally isn't personal unless it's a sort of really right-wing paper that have got a sort of an agenda to bring down, you know, people like myself. But I always thought, well, if there's something good happening, they'll write that. And if there's something bad happening, they'll write that. There's a point where you can't take it personally because it is so schizophrenic. Because who do you listen to? Do you listen to the people saying you're awful or do you listen to people saying you're amazing? Somewhere in the middle, there's a kind of sanity place that you can go, well, I'm kind of both.
We mentioned Bowie a couple of times as he had such an influence on you. As you must have met him a bunch of times. What was he like?
He was beautiful.
Of course he was.
Very kind to me. I mean, I know he could be a number. I've heard stories where he could be quite difficult, but I kind of went into every meeting with him as such a fan, you know, and he knew I was a mad fan. And in fact, he remembered meeting me before I was famous because I did an internet chat with him in the 90s. And I said, oh, we've never met. And he goes, oh, I've met you. He goes, I remember meeting you at the Blitz.
What?
I mean, obviously, I was quite striking looking at that point. I was, you know, I had hair shooting up, you know, 4 feet off my head and I was wearing kimonos and, you know, so he remembered me. And I was amazed by that. And when I actually sort of spent quality time with him, he was super charming and just very sweet. I remember having dinner with him in New York and I took one of my best friends, Michael Cavadillas, with me. He's also a Nutty Bowie fan. And he was so nice to Michael. He just made everyone feel really welcome. And he was very flirty and funny and charming. And he was just everything I wanted him to be. He couldn't have been nicer. Like to the point where I wanted to cry after I met. Like, oh my God, he was so nice. The one sort of real evening I spent with him, you know, I was able to walk away and say, oh my God, he was just brilliant. You know, just, he read us, you know, he just knew how to behave.
What's the Bowie track we should play then?
It should be something from Black Star.
Oh yeah.
If I ever see the English evergreens I'm running to. What's that song? Dollar Days. Yeah, I mean, listen, the Black Star album, I got that and I was flying to America and I had it on headphones on the flight. And I remember the stewardess coming to give me some tea and I was sobbing like in a pool of tears by the end of listening to that record, because it was so, I think it was the most emotional record that Bowie ever made, because he knew he was dying. So many things in it that just hit me as a fan, you know, the lyrics, just everything about it. And when I first heard, there were some tracks from that album, there was that song called Sue that came out a little bit before the album, and I couldn't get my head around the rhythm of it. I just couldn't get it. I was like playing it, and what is this? But by the time the album came out, I'd sort of acclimatized to that groove, and I was like, this album is so good. And so, yeah, I just remember listening to it and just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. He was so much a part of our lives and, you know, for me, so instructive on who I became and what I wanted to do. You know, I mean, I've actually been called in Q magazine the Hampstead Bowie, wannabe Hampstead Bowie, and I don't take that as an insult, you know. I think it's a good thing to want to be.
Back to Culture Club. When was the first moment when you thought, this is done, it's gone as far as it can?
We sort of never really broke up. We just stopped speaking to each other for like periods of time. But we never really officially sort of said it's over. We just fell out. And it's really difficult to escape people that you've created something monumental with.
Yeah.
It's like having kids with someone. And it's really impossible to just walk away and never speak to those people again. But I think every day in Culture Club, at the height of the band's success, because I was having this awful relationship with John, it just made everything unpleasant. You know, there wasn't really a lot of fun to be had because I was always upset about something John had done, or I was jealous or whatever it was. And, you know, the songs were a kind of diary to what was going on in my head. I mean, I'm rewriting Taboo at the moment. And one of the things I wrote was, I wish I'd been more radical. Falling in love is so old fashioned. You know, because when I think back, I should have been much cooler and more indifferent. I should have slept with more people because I had boys throwing themselves at me, but I just wanted a boyfriend. So I really was quite shockingly unradical in some ways, you know, and I obviously nowadays it would never happen. But then it was like such driving force to what I was doing. And anytime he upset me, I wanted to write a song about it. But, you know, one great thing John did say to me in the middle of all that madness, I remember playing in a song and saying, oh, it's about you. And he went, all your songs are about yourself. They are. They're about me because they're about my attempts to manage whatever I had been taught about relationships from my parents.
Can you remember first thinking, if I don't address my substance abuse issues, this is not going to end well? Was there a moment? Was there that moment of clarity?
I don't think there was. I think, right, like all addicts, I just thought, I'm fine. Just being ridiculous. I'm fine. I can handle it, you know. And it was really other people that kind of forced me into a corner. It was the press. It was the band. It was my family. I was kind of like a fox in the headlights at one point. You know, there was nowhere to run. There were paparazzis outside my flat and cars. I couldn't go and score anyway because everywhere I went, people were selling stories and taking photos. So it almost became impossible to leave the house. And eventually, like most things in my life, it was kind of accidental that I got clean, just like it was accidental that I got famous. You know, I've read stories about Courtney Love, like writing these lists about what she's going to do, like, I'm going to become famous, I'm going to do this. And I never really did that. In the early days, I was obsessed with having a relationship. I wanted a boyfriend. So that was really all I cared about. And being on the road meant I was with John. So that's why I loved being on the road. One of the reasons why John hated it. He never wanted to tour because he had to put up with me. And it's one of those mad things of Culture Club, because the thing that drove the whole thing was the thing that destroyed it as well.
You mentioned Taboo earlier. Can you remember the opening night, which I believe was January the 29th, 2002? Because that would have been quite an experience seeing, I mean, obviously the amount of work it takes to do a production like that, but also something so personal.
Yeah, I remember before we opened, seeing Matt Lucas playing Lee Bowery for the first time in full costume and just freaking out, because I'd seen Matt on Shooting Stars.
Yeah.
I just went into the production and was like, you know what? Why don't we get Matt Lucas to play Lee Bowery? He kind of looks like Lee. And it happened. I don't know how it happened, but it did. I remember the first time seeing Matt in a bath, you know, dressed as Lee. Just thinking, oh my God, this is so exciting. And obviously the young kid that played me, Ewan Morton, was so good. Like, he had the most beautiful voice. And even though he was short, there was something about him that was reminiscent of me, weirdly. There's something about the kind of makeup process, because even when the BBC did Worried About the Boy, Douglas Booth played me, and he's a really handsome, suave movie star, but somehow with a yellow face and arched eyebrows, he looked exactly like me. There's something about that makeup and the sort of costumes that transform almost anyone, apart from Ronnie Corbett. and also Serge Gainsbourg dressed up as me. It's hilarious.
What?
It's the most shocking thing ever.
I've got to go Google that now.
I loved him, and I met him a few times, and I was so embarrassed when I saw this. I was like, oh my God, what are you doing? Because he was quite drunk, and it wasn't complimentary. But in general, that kind of look really transforms people into me. It's quite mad. Well, it even does that to me.
Down the booth, let the demons win the fight. drop my gloves to the ground. You know I'm sorry for the times I made you cry. I made it harder letting you down. You used to say it's only me I'm hurting, but I saw you on the stage. The kid was crying and the dogs were howling and a siren filled the air. What's the word? Have I lost my crown? Or will I be king again? What's the word on the street? Have I lost my crown? Or will I be king of everything? Tempting myself time and time again. Like self-destruction was so cruel.
This Is What I Do, 2013. That record, I mean, people called it a comeback. I think it was the one that really reminded people what you were capable of as a musician, that record.
Yeah, I remember doing it. I remember going on the road with that album. I took a 12-piece band to America. It cost me money to do the tour. I didn't make any money, but for me, it was reputational. It was like really important that I went out and said to people, this is what I actually do, you know. We played like really interesting small little clubs. It wasn't like the 80s. It was really downbeat and edgy and exciting. And, you know, a lot of people still say to me those gigs were some of the best gigs they ever went to, you know, because it was such a break from what I'd been doing, you know.
The film, I believe there is the film. Is this right? Is this the big...
There's talk of the film.
Yeah. What can you tell me about the talk of the film?
Well, what's been discussed is about me and Marilyn using that as the kind of root of it. It's almost like the divine feud.
Okay.
Which actually could be quite interesting because there is a really interesting thread in our relationship from the 70s right through to now, even, you know, without, I don't want to highlight too much of what she gets up to these days, but there is this strange connection. And when I was asked about our relationship, I remember that my dad sent a dead pigeon to Marilyn in the 80s.
Nice.
Because he kind of blamed Marilyn for like leading me up, you know, the path of self-destruction. So he felt like it was like a sort of mafia warning from my dad. He sent Marilyn a dead pigeon. That's going to be a brilliant scene if it ever happens.
But it might happen. The talk is big. Yeah. And the final thing we always ask everybody is to pick the final song that we'll play. What final song shall we finish on? It can be anything you want. Where should we end the show?
Ooh. There's loads. I think if I was going to play one song, it would be Free Money by Patti Smith.
Why that song?
It just is my favourite song. You know, it's such a romantic, beautiful love song, you know, just, you know, oh, baby, I'll give you everything you need. I'll buy you a jet stream, baby. Take you to the stratosphere, you know, just the lyrics. You know, every day before I go to sleep, I win a lottery. You know, it's all about giving someone everything. I'm a massive Patti Smith fan. And in fact, I met her once. I went up to her in a restaurant and I was like, I never do this. I'm so sorry, but I love you. And she was like, and I said, I'm Boy George. And she goes, wow, when did you grow a beard? And I said, I've had it for a few years. She goes, you're really handsome. And I was like, oh! Free Money by Patti Smith.
Then that's the song we're going to play. Thank you so much. It's been really lovely to talk to you, sir.
Thank you.
Every night before I go to sleep, find a ticket, win a lottery, scoop the pearls up from the sea, cash them in and buy you all the things you need. Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills go swirling at my bed.
jet plane, babe. Get you on a higher plane to a jet stream and take you through the stratosphere and check out the planet and then take you down deep where it's hot, hot in the radio, baby, then cool, cold, you feel the snow and we'll roll, drain, roll, drain, roll, roll, drain, drain. When we're dreaming, when we're dreaming, when we're dreaming.
That was Patti Smith with Free Money, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time today, Boy George. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Isabel Campbell. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from this run, including my conversations with Bernard Butler and Corinne Bailey-Ray, as well as shows from the First Time archive, including my chat with Tom York. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.